brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
Welcome back to Soft Rip Radio. In studio this morning, I have Tim Larkin. Tim is America's leading pro-victim rights and personal safety advocate. No stranger to controversy, after being named the 2011 Self-Defense Instructor of the Year and simultaneously inducted into the Black Belt Hall of Fame, Tim ended the year by taking on the UK Home Secretary after getting banned from the UK for his stand on citizens' rights to defend themselves from imminent violence, which was interesting. I was reading up on that whole thing. It was crazy.
That was nuts.
Currently, Tim was appealing the decision from the UK, basically banned from entering the UK, which to me is crazy. Like, they'll let people from Syria in the country, but not Tim the American. You do a lot of speaking engagements. You've got this amazing business, which I'd love to get into in a bit. And then your latest book is When Violence is the Answer, which is pretty badass title. Learning how to do what it takes when your life is at stake. And then Tim and I share a mutual friend who has been on the show a few times, Kamal Lavakant, who introduced us. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having
us this morning. Man, I wish we could have got our coffee talk recorded for the show prior, which I definitely took a few more notes. But just, I guess, why don't we start with I read the bio, but would love to hear kind of your origin story, kind of where you grew up and how you got into what you're doing now, and including, I read online your bio that you were an officer and a candidate in BUDS and had that diving accident. So I'd love to kind of like cover all that and up to now and what you're doing.
I grew up a Navy brat. You know, dad was a surface warfare officer, so he rode ships, but spent a lot of time in Virginia Beach, spent a lot of time in San Diego. Other places dad lived, but when we moved to San Diego, I actually lived on Navy housing in Coronado, and right across the street was this crazy place. And my brother and I looked at it. It looked like a cool obstacle course we could play on. And so we figured we'd ride our bikes over there. And then one Sunday night, you know, we're going to sleep. You know, dad's already deployed. Literally, we've been there less than 2 weeks. All of a sudden, it's like World War III just went off. We were scared. We were frightened. We had no idea what was going on. My mom was scared to death. She was about to call, and just as she's doing it, next door, Sam Christensen came by. Eric Christensen, who was killed in Red Wing. Yeah. He lived right next door to me. Sam Christensen is a really good friend of my mom. She runs over two wine glasses and a bottle of wine. Carol, don't worry about it. It's just the SEALs.
Yeah.
That was my introduction, you know? So I was fascinated after that. Got to really know a lot of the guys as a young kid. I was like 12 years old. And they were awesome. They told me everything about training. I was sold. That was all I wanted to do. Been taking cold showers since 12 years old. Get prepped. I knew everything. What was interesting was I went through, and the reason I tell people this story is because this is what happened to me. You know, it's a shark tank. If you go in there, if you show any sign of weakness or anything, you just get ostracized. Well, I was the opposite. I was the number one guy. I was weeks away from going. I was going to go to SEAL Team 4, which back then was doing all counter-narcotics.
Yeah.
I was full of myself.
Yeah.
I was going for Anchorman, the whole deal. Got absolutely humbled a couple weeks out, just on a normal dive, just doing some explosives on a Jap Scully. Blew my ears. First time in my life that I had ever had a true injury to the human body. I'd been hurt, knocked down, cracked ribs, stuff like that. This absolutely went into vertigo underwater.
This was were you guys doing the San Clemente?
No, this was out. This is just out at the dives off of the bayside. Okay. You know, all the big evolutions that already passed. Back then, San Clemente was second phase, third phase was dive.
Got it.
So you go from being the number one guy in the class to like a pariah. You know, all of a sudden, I'm there. Everybody was cool about it, but they just knew. What was interesting was what I thought ended my career was the start And that's where I learned injury to the human body and how that bypasses bigger, faster, stronger. And that's how I started down the road of looking at self-protection a little bit differently from a violence standpoint of it. Stayed in. We did a pilot course. I was an intelligence officer. They sent me to Intel School at Damneck. Came back, worked directly for NavSpec Warcom for Admiral Loyne. When, at the very first place, I mean, we had like little trailers out there at the beginning. So it was an interesting time because that's when everybody went purple. And all of a sudden, I'm this junior guy in a very senior command, and I had access to like incredible stuff that I had no business having access to. They kept me there because I was I understood the thing. They knew I'd gone through training. I had a good rep, but they didn't have to give a healthy body that because we were trying to expand during that time. And so here I am, this intel guy, and they're sending me around to work with everybody. And it was a fascinating time, made incredible contacts during that time. But one of the things we did was we relooked at hand-to-hand combat. The Berlin Wall came down, and I had like some of the legends of the SEAL team on that staff. And they just started saying, they actually predicted what's going on today. And they said, yeah, we got to start changing the way we train. And one of the things they knew was we're going to start putting hands on people again.
Yeah.
That was the start. And that's where we started looking for, you know, a different way to look at hand-to-hand combat, which then, you know, almost 30 years later now has morphed into what I do full time, which is, you know, my system. But it had its nexus, you know, beginning right there.
Yeah, I still remember, just back to the injury thing. I mean, I know how tough that is because I still remember a guy in our class, Eli, is like just a good guy. And after like made it through Hell Week and he had a back problem, they x-rayed him. He was basically had a broken back, like finished Hell Week with a broken back, but it ended his time at Buds. But that's just, part of it is just luck, right? You just get.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, you have to have the tenacity to get through. The one thing that I always have felt good about is obviously I didn't quit, but you can't control what's going to happen in your body. I saw really good guys get injured, you know, on Rock Portage, things like that. And that was it. You know, they couldn't recover from that. It's interesting. You learn a lot about yourself during that time. You learn you can do 10 times more than you thought you could, but you also realize that there's an element, like you said, there is an element of luck of getting through that training.
Not to go completely off track, but I feel like, you know, I got to team three in 98, the end of 98. And I felt like the teams, even though we weren't like team three and four were kind of the two operational teams because stuff was happening in the Middle East, stuff was happening in South America, team four. And then we had still had the old Vietnam guys. I think we had at least three of them at team three. This guy, Womack, we called him, his nickname was Half-Ass McCarthy because he had a half his ass literally blown off in Vietnam. Like really good guys, but I feel like it's a shame that, and I won't go too deep on this, but, and you know this from being an officer, there was no upward mobility in the SEAL community pre-9/11. No. Once you do that platoon commander spot, you're done operationally. And so a lot or most of the good officers would get out. They would go, okay, I'm going to go do something else, go to business school. And the guys that kind of stayed when 9/11 happened, they got promoted up. And a lot of people don't want to talk about this, but really we had this brain drain of officers pre-9/11 and all of a sudden massive upward mobility and these guys get promoted up. And I just look at, you know, when I got out in 2006, I started to see like we had real problems in the community. Guys were getting over deployed because the system of a promotion was encouraging guys to deploy, which is not good for them psychology of it and just not good for family life. But you're in with the boys and the pressure is like, okay, well, he's a good guy because I know he's been like deployed five times. And and I feel like the leadership of the SEAL community has let the community down. And we're at the place we are today where guys are murdering a fellow Green Beret in Africa. You got this war crime stuff going on. And I'm almost like, I'm not pointing the fingers at these guys that are involved. But I'm like, why didn't we failed them as leaders? Like, and then this, I forget his name, the Admiral came out. I was like, I think we have a cultural problem. I wanted to smack him in the face and go, dude, just go look at the headlines the past 10 years. Like, this is a major problem. So, you know, it's just sad to me because I felt like the SEAL team that I belong to and signed up for has changed dramatically. It's just like it's in big trouble, like culturally right now.
Well, I got in before you in that community before you. And what was interesting about the community I got into, they were the ex-Vietnam guys that were in there, but they also were the guys, the upside of the fact that you couldn't promote, you would have a lieutenant commander tell a three-star to go to hell. If he thought it was, they were really protecting their guys.
Yeah.
What I noticed was when we did the expansion in the late 80s and we tried to get up to 10 teams, like we just, what they didn't understand was there's a reason for the attrition rate. Now, I'm a product of the attrition rate. The one thing I will say about that is I tried to game the system. So when I got in, I'll give you a great example of good leadership. I got in to the Admiral's Command. They loved me. They were there. The guys, you probably know some of the guys that were my bosses. They really liked me. And so I applied for a freaking waiver for my ears. I was that arrogant that I figured I could pull it. And I got it all the way up. Even Ray Smith, who became an admiral later, he okayed me. He tells me, he goes, I almost blew my ears right before that.
Smith is a great guy. He was an advisor in my first company that I started.
He's a stellar. He helped me out so much. So it got all the way up to Lemoyne, the admiral. Lemoyne sits me down and he says to me, he goes, wow. He looked at all my recommendations and everything. He goes, normally I just sign this. He goes, and I have no problem signing this. He goes, I just got to ask you one question. And, anybody knew Adam Lemoyne, he had a stutter, but he was a very precise guy. And he was a very smart guy, the way he did things. He got criticism on some things, but he was a very sober guy. He saw where this could go, what we're just talking about now, and he didn't want it to go there. That's why he wanted to keep the SEALs a little bit separate. So he says to me, he goes, okay, you're a platoon commander now, and we're running a mission, and your ears so far have been okay. And now you go and you're getting locked out of the sub. The mission starts and your ears go and you're done. And he goes, you probably have more than half the intel that the group needs. And now you're out of it. Now your second has to take over. He goes, if you're sitting in my seat right now, what would you tell you? And it was like the most brutal. And I said, and that just ended my fantasy right there. Yeah. And I said, what can you do? Ethically, I sat there and said, you're absolutely right, sir. He said, I will help you on anything you want to do. He goes, I think you're great. Problem was back then, you couldn't just transfer to the Army. Now you can. Now you can.
Yeah, inner service.
But that was the kind of guys I grew up with. And I absolutely agree with you. I think where it happened, though, I don't know if it's kind of before you got to the teams. Where we really saw it was after Gulf War One. After Gulf War One, it got really bad to be in the military, and everybody got out.
Yeah, that was definitely a contributing factor, I think, because guys just weren't doing, they weren't operating. But you just have the environment, especially in the Clinton era, right? I enlisted in the Clinton era, but I guess, and the reason I went there is because I had dinner last night with two good friends of mine and we had a long talk about, because they were asking me, these guys are like accomplished guys. One of my friend Mike has a food show on PBS for 16 years. And he was like, hey, what's going on with all this shit and the headlines and these war crimes? And so I went deep with these guys, and I've always had a passion for aviation. And I got in with these group of fighter pilots who fly military aircraft twice a year. We have like this fight club in San Diego, and it's like full on, like very safe, but all Top Gun guys. I've flown with guys that have 400 hours flying the space shuttle. But I look at that, the aviation community and the military, is the leadership is so strong inside and outside of the military. And I think that, what the SEAL community needs is stronger leadership and in a more robust like community outside on off active duty, right? When guys get out, because they're lost. Yeah. They go from this being number one to kind of outside on their own. There's no real network. We used to have the reunion, but it's like the reunion is very toxic. Yeah. Guys are shit talking each other, pointing fingers. Anyone who writes a book is on the shit list. And it just creates this like nasty environment outside of the active duty community where the brotherhood does exist, but when you're out, it does not. And that's why these guys are killing themselves. And the fact that the community is in a really bad spot. Like, we've let some things go on and looked the other way, and things have just kind of gotten out of control with drugs, all the shit you're seeing in the headlines now.
I remember back in 2000, I think I had this conversation like 2009, one of my buddies had just taken over as a CO of one of the SEAL teams, because I don't know, I won't say what it was, but that conversation haunts me right now. Because he said, he goes, listen, he goes, we're going down a bad path. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, Tim, you don't understand. He goes, my guys, he goes, they're deployed.
Yeah.
And I said, so we've talked about the obvious of what that does to you mentally and everything. He looked at it from a professional development side. He goes, I can't get my senior enlisted into schools that they need to go to be better leaders.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing the effects of that because the op tempo has been so crazy.
Yeah.
And you need a leadership to just be able to say no.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know? And they don't.
And that's kind of my point. Just seeing the admiral say, he sends this all hands letter after this platoon gets sent home from, I think the entire unit from Team 7 gets sent home. Like, yeah. That's a big red flag, man. And if you're saying, I think we have a problem, you're part of the problem, in my opinion. And that's where we just need to take a really hard look in the mirror. And I hope that the community does that as well as creates a better environment on the outside. Because back to my kind of experience with this fighter pilot group, they have a strong community outside of when they leave active duty. And the camaraderie is still there, the friendship, the networking, the helping out. They're not like shit talking each other in the media, jabbing each other online on social media. It's like a very different environment because they have really strong leadership and a history dating back pre probably World War II of just really taking care of their guys. And I feel like that, you know, I can't speak for the broader special ops community, but the SEAL community for sure could use that. And the proof is in the pudding. I mean, nobody wants to read those headlines, but if you just Google some of that stuff, it's prolific.
And there's a lot of unreported stuff
that's
still out there. It's just, it's this idea, you know, kind of getting back to the idea of dealing with violence on a regular basis.
Yeah.
You know, I have tons of friends from very NATO spec ops groups. And I got one buddy who's, he's in his mid 50s now, and he just can't get off the train. He has to keep, he's a contractor.
Yeah.
You know, he did years with the Australian SAS, did that whole deal. That wasn't enough for him. He had to keep going back. Had an amazing job in Australia, but he just missed the action.
Yeah.
And I see it become an addictive quality in some guys, and it's dangerous. It's really sad, you know, that you get there because these guys have already done amazing service. It's not that they haven't performed. It's just, I don't think there's enough to educate people and reintegrate them back into society correctly.
Yeah, no, it's a big, big problem right now as a whole. I mean, we could spend 2 hours talking about the VA, how fucked up the VA is, but thanks for kind of riffing with me on that one. But I do want to talk about your current business and we get into the book as well. But so you're headquartered in Las Vegas.
Yes.
And you run training for anybody who can come to Vegas and sign up for a course. Can you talk
about
that?
We started out military and law enforcement. We do it all over. They do it all over the world. You know, we offer base seminars for civilians. That really happened after 9/11. Basically, I was doing contract work really up till 9/11. We were doing kind of Blackwater type stuff down in Venezuela before Blackwater. That was really interesting. And I always thought at that time, I thought the methods that we teach of injury to the human body, I always thought for the civilian population, it would be tough for them to accept. And then 9/11 happens. And all of a sudden, I got a bunch of corporate CEOs who travel. They want training. You know, I did this seminal product on the 8th and 9th of September, right by the World Trade Centers. You know, I fly home on the 10th, I wake up on the 11th, it happens. Where I trained was destroyed. Three of my guys were in the building, they got out. They were all international, you know, finance guys that flew a lot. The information that I gave out in that course that we filmed, and it was only supposed to be for them, you know, that's when we released that to the public, and we just got a really big response during that time. I think what's interesting is in this culture right now, we try to suppress anything that might make somebody feel bad. We don't want to deal with the fact that, you know, in the real world, we live in a physical world, and that one of those realities is there's a tool out there that should be available to everybody called violence. But unfortunately, the tool is only available, really acceptably available right now to the predators. It hasn't been that way. Like my grandfather, you know, when he grew up, it was just a basic rite of passage that you learned how to protect yourself. You learned the rules, you know, you learned that you didn't start anything, but that if you needed violence, you know, you used it because there wasn't a first responder that's going to get there in time.
It's funny because I read the subway in New York And every time I get on the subway, it's just like being aware of your environment, right? Like I always check out the car and you can see the kind of predators on the train because they see you notice them, right? And you're like, okay. Like it's just like this kind of unspoken rule, right? Because you just look at these guys and like, okay, that guy's up to no good. Like that guy's trouble. But and he knows you now know, you know, he's up. But most people just go about their day and don't even pay attention to that stuff.
I showed a video. I did a talk at Google and I said, okay, how am I going to grab these guys out of the gate? And then I realized I had a really great clip. So there's a clip of a robbery that took case on a Seattle bus. A guy is literally walking down the bus and he's got his gun and he's just going from person to person, ripping them off. And nobody's talking to anybody. Everybody's immersed in their phones.
Yeah.
And what got them was the one guy that he's literally immersed in his phone, ears and eyes just gone. The gun comes in. He redirects the vector. He steps up, redirects the vector and goes in. You think, oh, good. He understands. And he has his phone in his hand. And you think, great. He's going to use it as a bludgeon. Now, this guy had a gun in his face. No, what does he do with the phone? He's putting it in his, he doesn't want to crack his screen. He's with his life on it. And I try to tell people, I go, you don't have no idea how much these things have taken over our city. It's not going to go away. We just need to be aware of it.
Yeah.
And that got everybody's attention at that point. I mean, because they saw themselves. They saw themselves when they were probably just immersed in a public area and unaware. That's probably the problem. The problem is exactly what you're saying. Predators take advantage of all of that.
Oh, yeah.
We just have to be aware of it. The problem is you're told that if you study the subject, that you're somehow you're advocating violence or that you are advocating criminal activity. And it's just a misunderstanding. What people don't understand is what people call self-defense is really after the fact. What we do is we use violence. And then after the act of violence has happened, it's going to be determined whether it was a justified use of the term. And if it's justified, they're going to call it self-defense and everything's away. If it's not, it's going to be a criminal use and now you're going to get processed through the legal system. How to navigate those waters is really the reason I wrote the book, because that's where most people make the mistake. They want to respond to things that are easily avoidable. And yet, when they are devoid of choice and they're facing imminent grievous bodily harm, oftentimes they want to talk.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the one time, that's one of the rare times when you actually need to use a tool of violence.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had this saying you're probably well familiar with in the SEAL community is like violence of action, right? And I was in Afghanistan after 9/11. Most of the ops we went on, which I mean, got over a dozen, no shots fired because we hit the target so fast and furious using this violence of action. By the time these guys are like hoods on their head or they're zip tied, you know, it was like after that settled in, they got pissed. You know, you could see the rage, but we were so, the violence of action just overwhelmed these guys and it just works, you know, especially I have a couple of buddies in New York. Jeff, my friend, is a CMO of VaynerMedia and he's a McDonald's All-American basketball collegiate guy. And he's an alpha dude, but he's always like fucking around with me. I'm like, Jeff, dude, I'm not going to like play fight you. Right. You know what I mean? It's like, it's because you don't know, like your version of of like college, you know, bar fights is like shoving back and forth and maybe one guy gets punched. Yeah. I was like, you have no idea like what real like, you know, combat fighting is like. It's just like not gonna go to completion. You know what I mean? Like you're solving for this equation and it's not, there's no tapping out, right?
Well, it's funny. You're probably the same way. Like, I love when people start screwing around with me because I know I have them at that point.
Yeah.
They think, oh, hey, Tim's just this nice guy and everything. No, I don't want anybody to know I know anything because if I need it, I want it to be a complete surprise. I want that violence of action and I want it to be sudden. But I'm shocked at how many guys who are alphas, and I've trained a lot of them, especially here in New York when I come here, that really misunderstand reality. Like I had a guy tell me, he was from Goldman, this is like mid-2000s. He told me about one of their traders. It wasn't a guy I trained. This guy was truly like, he was one of those world-class traders, really full of himself. He was out one time and they're walking the streets, him and two other friends. These two guys approached them, said, you know, tried to rob them. He goes, oh, you want to fight?
Oh, Jesus.
And he literally goes, okay, we're going to fight. He goes to take off his jacket because, you know, it's an expensive jacket. So he figures he's going to, as he's taking it down here, the two guys look at each other, draw their knives, and they stab him to death right in front because he was imagining like you're talking about, the male locker room, back and forth alpha state, these guys just do it.
That's my exact point. I mean, you made my exact point. Yeah, I mean, I started carrying pepper spray in the city because I came out of a building in Soho. I carry this aerosol. Yeah. And this crazy homeless guy, like, immediately ran up to me, grabbed me, and he clearly, like, schizophrenic, but I'd never been, like, grabbed before. And I was like, man, what am I going to do with this guy? And I ended up getting him off me, but I was like, took like, you know, probably 45 seconds, but it was still like more than I wanted to, and I didn't want to like grapple with this guy. But I was like, man, if I had that pepper spray, I would just blast him and walked away. He ended up, this girl I was dating at the time, she tried to like get involved. I was just thinking to myself, like, what are you doing? And he'd start chasing her and I had to like go run that down. And
well, you had another incident here that I used to talk about in the early 2000s, an actress, her boyfriend and another couple. They're walking home. They decided to walk home from a club in the Lower East Side. And back then it was a little more dicey to do that. So instead of grabbing a cab, they decided to walk home about 2:30 at night. They get confronted. Guy pulls out a gun. Other guy knocks the girl down, pulls her purse. The actress, who also has a lot of brothers, she just decides to bone up on him, and she just gets in the guy's face. And the guy's like holding the gun, and I guess from all accounts, he had a confused look on his face when she was doing this. And she's like, you know, going off, trying to be an alpha. And she goes, what are you going to do, shoot me? And he just goes, yeah. Boom, boom, and killed her right then and there, you know, on it. And it's a completely a misunderstanding of what true violence is and what a true threat is versus what a social confrontation is, you know. And what happens is a lot of people make the mistake. They live in these worlds where they operate in an inner office environment or whatever their social environment is, and you're able to get away with a lot of stuff because it's a shared community and you know everybody. As soon as you walk out that door, you have no idea what the background is. You don't know what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And that's where people make a hell of a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally agree. It reminds me of Sear School. I don't know if you ever went to Sear School. So it's like sometimes you just have to swallow your pride and wait for an opportunity, right? You can't, you're disadvantaged. I remember yesterday I'm in YPO and I was talking to this gal, Deborah, who is an active shooting survivor. She'd been shot 4 times. She was driving in Santa Monica. It's like a lady like now is like a venture capitalist in LA, like very successful woman. She was driving through a Santa Monica neighborhood, rolled up, and there was like a SWAT team and this guy on the lawn who actually just like shot 2 people, I think family members in the house, came out, and he was like drawing down with the rifle on this lady next door. She kind of like was confused and then put it all together, like drove in between this guy, the shooter, and the lady, and ended up getting shot. He shot the car like 20 times, shot her 4 times, but she survived. But anyway, I was telling her my experience. This was the summer where they had the Paris attacks and a couple of attacks in Germany. I was coming back from Europe, JFK, and got off the plane at Terminal, I think it was Terminal 1. They held us at the gate and said, hey, there's a potential shooter in Terminal 7. And we're like, oh, this is crazy. So then they said, okay, 15 minutes later, we're all clear. Get through passport control. I get through and I'm waiting for my bag. Now they're like, the whole place is filled up, like 300-400 people. And all of a sudden I hear screaming and like 6 armed officers run into the baggage area and starts yelling at us to run for our lives that there's an active shooter. And it was complete like pandemonium. And I was like, shit, I gotta just like, first, there was nothing, I felt really helpless because people were panicking, screaming, kids were being left behind, those like little barriers were being blown over. People ran outside on the tarmac where it like blew through the security doors. And I was like, shit, man, like, what am I gonna do? I don't have anything. I'm gonna go take cover behind this concrete column. And I remember looking up at the officer that was there with me, and she was like shaking with the gun. And it was clear, like, okay, these guys have a plan to deal with a threat, but they don't know what to deal with the scared passengers, like all these panicked people. There was no plan to deal with that. And we ran outside. I eventually made a decision. Okay, that's a safe area. Like, there's a threat coming. And I get outside and I'm talking to one of the officers. I'm like, hey, what's going down? I'm texting my friends, and he was like, hey, we don't know. There's a shooter in there reported. there might be a couple. He's like, can you help me get these people back inside? I'm like, dude, that's the worst thing we can do right now. I was like, you have no idea what, like,
total
we know
lack
there's
of understanding.
Like, a, yeah, totally. Yeah. Lack. I was like, you're going to put these people back inside? At least here they have options. They could run and get away. This little Jewish girl overheard me and she's like, I'm going with you. And so I ended up taking six passengers underneath the airport at JFK, where they kind of load the bags on the right. conveyor belt up into the airport, underneath, around the fence. And I remember seeing like all the taxis and Ubers just kind of stopped, like looking like what the hell's going on, because everybody knew something was up. And I'm like, realized I'm in a black polo, black pants, and I have my black backpack. And I got these people, and I'm like throwing my jacket over the barbed wire so they could climb. And the lady, she's like, no, you have to go first and help. So I go over and I see this fucking Jersey guy running at me. I could just tell, like, this guy. And he was, like, thinking I'm, like, some terrorist.
Oh, yeah.
You
know?
Yeah, he's like, oh, shit, I got one. And I'm like, no, like, we're helping these people. And so he ended up helping us. And we got in cabs. I said, we need to get the hell out of here because they're going to shut the roads down. They're going to close this place down. It turned out somebody had phoned it in, a hoax, to Terminal 1 and Terminal 7. A combination between that, it was when that Uday Hussein won that race.
Right.
So you had people yelling and cheering. An officer AD'd, had an accidental discharge, and it kicked off complete panic. Yeah. But I had never experienced anything like it in my life. I was blown away. And I've been through multiple hooded box drills, yep. Dwayne Dieter's course. Like, yep. And, you know, I think it was just like, it was so out of my control. So I really try and avoid busy times on the subway because I don't ever want to get caught up in that mass crowd, like panicked crowd, because you can't do anything. You're just like, you get trampled. Like I saw kids getting trampled. So it was really terrifying. But I wrote an article about it because I said, look, there's things that you can do. For instance, looking at the Paris attack, right? Like some people just tip the table over, close their eyes, and we're just like praying for it to go away. And they're getting shot through these wooden tables because right. they don't understand the difference between cover and concealment. And the thing is, you got to get off the X, right? Like yep. you have to put distance between yourself and the threat. And it just, look, if you live in a major metropolitan city anywhere in the world today, you're at risk. Like we have this, unfortunately, you know, terrorism is a real thing. So I'm glad guys like you are putting out the training and this book, like When Violence is the Answer, because people need to be a little bit better prepared. And it could save, you know, in Deborah's situation, she was bullied as a kid and was, you know, took karate and self-defense. It was just like the anti-bully in her took over, she said.
Right.
But we need more people like that in the world. And I'm shocked that this UK thing is just, it's just silly to me that you're getting banned from entering the UK.
We're literally, today, we actually sent it off. I've been invited by Parliament. I have a lot of ministers of Parliament that actually are very supportive, and they've invited me to come speak to the House of Parliament. Right. So we're putting this big push to bring me back, because since just last year, I think there was 41,000 knife attacks in the UK, which is insane. I went to school in the UK. I did University of London, London School of Economics for a year in the 80s. It was the safest place. And what was interesting was the difference back then was you had the same diversity that London's always had. But what was interesting was if you talk to a Pakistani store owner back then, he was proud to be part of the UK. He wanted to assimilate. He wanted his family to assimilate. I noticed when I kept going to London, you know, during those years in the early 2000s before I got banned, I just noticed this polarization that we're seeing where people would literally section off. You weren't made to feel welcome in certain parts of a town. It was bad. I didn't realize how bad it was getting. The problem is you've got people that don't understand violence and they don't understand that. And you have an influx of cultures that they literally looked around at the UK and they said, wait a minute, you guys don't use guns and you don't use knives because they tell you can't, yet they're readily available.
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to start using them. And it just shocked everybody. And what really became a problem over there, and this is what I talked to the point, is I made a comment after the riots in 2012, 2011. It was the idea that I go, this is a great opportunity for the UK to look at their self-defense laws and redefine them, because prior to 1950, they had amazing self-defense laws, fantastic ones. In the 50s, there were some well-meaning reasons why they changed the self-defense law. They had some problems with gangs using excuses. And they came in with the kind of draconian self-defense laws that basically said the only people that can take action are, you know, trained officers. And that if you take action, even if something that's ridiculously justified, you're going to be culpable for that.
Yeah.
So people just hands off. It's backfired on them big time.
I mean, we had that a little bit in America, right? Like, not necessarily in self-defense, but even that's why they passed that Good Samaritan law, right? Like, the U.S. is so litigious. It's like a whole nother topic I could talk about. Just like, you know, people slip, you know, by their own fall or bump their head at a restaurant and they're suing the owner, right? And it's like these people were trying to give CPR and then family was suing them. Oh, you killed my parent or whatever. So they passed that Good Samaritan law. But I feel like that, yeah, it should be something similar, right?
Well, I tell people all the time, I go, the reason the U.S. is able to entertain a lot of the positions that we take, I'll just say it that way, all over the place, is because we are so good at violence, meaning we have a very powerful military, we are in protected shores, and we have the luxury of playing games that other countries don't. And I notice that, you know, that's why I highly encourage people to travel. My kids are going to travel, because when you get outside the U.S., it's interesting. Like Western Europe and Western and the United States, when I give seminars, I spend a good portion of the time conditioning people and handling the legal questions.
Yeah.
You know, they don't understand that when I talk about something, I talk about a threat, you know, the conditions for our training are this. We assume multiple attackers. We assume they're all bigger, faster, and stronger, and we assume weapons. We also assume that the threat that we're talking about is you're devoid of choice, meaning if you don't take action, you're facing grievous bodily harm. Had you an exit, if you could have talked your way out of it, you already would have done that. So we're very clear on our parameters, to the point that if you had a firearm, you would feel justified emptying it into the threat.
Yeah.
So it's a very high standard, easy for people to understand. Even when you put that down, you'll still get some, you know, well, what about legality of this, that? You go into other countries. I go to India. I go to South America. I go here. Their questions are, no, wait a minute. Where on the body do you want me to strike?
Yeah,
they want to know specifics, because they have no problem. They understand when violence is appropriate, and they just want to make sure they have good information.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Unintended consequences. So we stopped training our police officers to use injury with batons. Now, my grandfathers, my great uncles were Boston cops. And I remember sitting around them just telling stories and just laughing when a guy would pull a knife, because they just pull out their stick, they'd go up, they'd break his wrist, and they're very comfortable and very competent on that. And yes, they broke the guy's wrist. He had an injury and he had to be healed, but he wasn't shot. Today, we default to lethal action.
Yeah,
we shoot people for things because we won't train people, because we don't want to deal. We don't have attorneys, the district attorneys, that can properly explain the efficacy of injury.
Yeah, it is a lack of training. And even I'm shocked in New York City at NYPD, only supervisors can carry non-lethal.
Yeah.
They're like the last person that needs the non-lethal. Like, you got to give these, like, the beat cops the non-lethal option, because the only other option is to pull a gun. Like, it's just crazy.
Yeah. And it's funny. My wife is a captain with Las Vegas Metro. She just got back from Israel. She did a 10-day counterterrorism. They take her all throughout the country, and she meets everybody. She came back. She goes, man, she goes, their average response time for any incident, any terrorist incident, is under 2 minutes.
Yeah. No, I can't.
And now, granted, it's a smaller country, and they've been dealing it for
citizen,
a long time.
The citizen army, understand. Too.
And, well, the reason the jihadists switched over to suicide bombing was because the citizens got so good at swarming shooters.
Yeah.
And I do an exercise in my training where I take everybody really calm, really calmly through a situation where they try to, an active shooter comes in, and we just go step by step by step. And their first job is just to try to get to the exit on the other side of the room. And as they're doing that, this guy goes through, and I do about 12 steps. He's able to get a shot off on each step. At least 12 people drop. They may not be dead, but they're shot. We then reverse it. And the only thing I have them do is, instead of step away from the shooter towards an exit, I have them step towards the shooter. Within 2 steps, somebody has a hand on the shooter. And it's just an education process, because I think a lot of times when they do active shooter training, especially for civilians, they just scare the hell out of them. They don't really give them good information. And the one thing I learned, and I don't know if you had this experience when you went through training, the one thing that always stuck with me from BUDS was, First phase, you just get psychotic freaking instructors. They're just destroying, you know? Yeah. And you realize they're able to do that because you really can only hurt yourself during that time. You really can't, you can hurt one of your other partners, but not as bad. As soon as we went out, second phase for me was weapons and explosives. We're out the island, man. Those same crazy instructors were like calm, you know, direct. Yeah. They wanted to make sure you got the information. What I learned was anytime I learned anything lethal, it was always delivered in a calm, deliberate manner. And that's where I wanted to install it. And I think that's probably one of the biggest problems when we deal with training people to deal with violence. I think oftentimes we go for pressure testing way too early.
Yeah.
You have to lay the foundation, yeah, you know? And once you understand violence, it doesn't, you don't have to become some super ninja or anything. But when you understand how violence works and how it operates, you can create a life that minimizes the chance of it ever ending your life. That's why it's worth studying the subject.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Instead of ignoring it. So the last question I want to ask you was just, can you share like a real world experience that stands out in your mind where you've actually had to apply your training? Can you share that story?
I've had to use it. Yeah. Probably Venezuela. When I was working in Venezuela, it was the first time I really dealt in a world that was just crazy. And this is pre-Chavez. I mean, people think, you know, Venezuela's had problems for a long time. We went down there, and back when we trained groups, we trained them to, they were trained as counter, it was law enforcement. Everything had to be under a law enforcement deal, and you had to get it approved by State Department. And so we did. We knew these guys we were training were not law enforcement. We knew they were out. They were just hunters, and they were going out because they had a problem with a lot of narcos and stuff. So we trained guys. They were of the mind that they like to test things out. They like to see where you were at. And I remember sitting in a car one time, and the gun was on me all of a sudden. This is one of the guys I'm training with. And he was there, and it was loaded, the whole thing. And I just, you know, where it was easy for me to just redirect the vector, turn right into him. I just jammed him in the throat. Then the senior guy, he goes, oh, stop. He had told the guy to do this because he just wanted to see what I could do, you know? And to me, it was just crazy. Then I find out everything we taught them on injury to the human body, they kept coming back to us the next day, and they'd go, that works really well. And I'm going, Jesus. You know, and we didn't think too much. And finally, he said something about one of the strikes. And I said, what do you mean it worked really well? He goes, oh, every night after we're done training with you, they go down to that famous prison. They pull out some guys that are on death row, and they just did it to them. They just wanted to make sure they wanted to validate that the information we were giving them was actually true. And just working in that world, and when you work in that world and you operate in that world, you understand that you have to be highly attuned to violence and to the potentiality for violence, and you have to deal with it in a calm way. You know, like, I could care less that the guy was testing me. I didn't know he was testing me. I thought, you know, it's Venezuela. I thought it could be, they're just sick of the gringo. They're going to take him out. There have been other times I've had to use the information, like in criminal applications and stuff, where if anything, it was disappointing because you never get to do, you know, the highest level of your training. It's usually very basic strikes that get you out of it. But what's funny is the more you train, the one thing I will tell people, the more you train, the more you see profiles, the less it throws you off. If I see a knife, it's probably the 10,000th time I've seen a knife come at me or something, which conditions you and trains you to where that's not a surprise anymore. And you deal with it. And what's funny is what I try to tell people is the most highly trained people that I know in lethal application, you know, that are not criminals, are the calmest, great senses of humor, love life. Most of them you would never know, you know, if you interact with them. And those are the guys I always admired. And those are the guys I always wanted to be like. Just this quiet confidence of they know, hey, I'm trained, I understand, but until something happens, I'm going to enjoy my life. I'm going to have a great life.
Yeah, nothing to prove.
Anyway. Yeah. And to me, that's the last thing I want to come off as to anybody is a badass, you know, because that puts you way behind the power curve.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my own kids took jiu-jitsu for, you know, 4 years, but it was just, you know, I remember what it did for their self-confidence. Yeah. You know, they just carry themselves a little bit more confident. And a lot of times that's all you need. Like, I remember my oldest son, Hunter, was a freshman, and he was wearing one of my SEAL shirts. I gave him like a SEAL Team 3 shirt, and one of the like seniors came up to him and gave him shit, and he just like looked at the guy with confidence, like, hey, that's just, looked him right in the eye and said, yeah, that's my dad. My dad was a SEAL. And it was just like, you know, having that little bit of confidence just kind of diffused the situation.
Yeah, because a lot of times people, they're going to socially test you, but they don't understand what the repercussions of doing that are. And that's what I'm saying. When you do it to the wrong person, like I laugh all the time. You know, I'm in my early 50s, but I still have a physical presence. I'm there. And people will say to me, well, yeah, you have this, you know, you have that look, you know, I got some tattoos and stuff like that. And I laugh.
You're a big guy.
And I laugh at people all the time. I go, yeah, this works. This presence works on everybody I don't care about.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. If this is enough to intimidate, you're not my threat. Yeah. You know, I know who I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And the scariest guys I know, they're probably anywhere from like, you know, 5'6 to 5'9, 145 to maybe 170 pounds, indescript. Yeah. If I see those guys rolling in with their, you know, a couple duffel bags, I'm out of there. Yeah. I know what's about to go down, you know?
Yeah.
It's just very funny. Violence is a very different tool. And I went into the prison systems and I was able to talk to a lot of the top corrections guys that interviewed Aryan Brotherhood, Black Guerrilla Family, Mexican Mafia. And you learn that these guys look at violence. Violence is currency for them. They look at it as a tool, and they're all results oriented. And I've been able to take that information, and you sit there and go, well, yeah, it's coming from the worst parts of society. Yes, and that's where the best information comes.
Yeah.
I just have to sanitize it for the general public. But I can put you on par with the worst of the predators on how they use the tool.
Yeah.
And that's the goal. You know, it should be available to everybody. What people don't understand is how you use the information.
Yeah, it's like that show Mindhunters, right? It's a great show. But they said, look, we're so outdated in the way we're trying to solve these cases. We have to get into the mind of these serial killers to understand and develop, you know, tactics to deal with this, to better investigate these crimes and profile. But yeah, no, it's great. I'd love to have you back on the show. I mean, I could go another hour with you, but the book is When Violence is the Answer, Learning How to Do What It Takes When Your Life is at Stake by Tim Larkin. And where can people find you online?
They can get me if they go to surviveviolence.com, I got a whole free program they can check out. It's really easy for them to remember.
Yeah, we'll put that link.
Yeah, and then When Violence is the Answer, the book you can get on Amazon. I got Audible and anything.
And you're on Instagram. I followed you this morning.
Yep. Yeah. TFT Tim Larkin.
Okay. TFT Tim Larkin.
Yeah. Or Tim Larkin TFT. Sorry.
I just typed in Tim Larkin and found it.
Yeah, you'll find me.
All right. Then a couple things before I check off. Again, have to have you back on the show. I'd love to get more into kind of some practical tips for the audience. I just had a couple things. We're doing a lifetime membership. Those of you that don't know, we relaunched softrep.com this week and basically created a centralized hub for all of our content under the Softrep domain name. And we're giving away a lifetime membership. Those that are interested in a lifetime membership, you can go to softrep.com/lifetime. We're only giving away a few hundred limited lifetime memberships. For the listeners of the show, we're giving away a custom Shane Hyatt knife. Shane will make a custom knife just for you. To enter, just email us at radio@softrep.com. That's radio@softrep.com. And just put knife in the subject line. And Shane is a good friend of mine. I've known him for years. He was at SEAL Team 3 Gulf Platoon with me. Just really passionate about making knives. He doesn't make a lot of them. I was telling Tim earlier, tried to get him to make some custom knives for our premium Crate Club members. And he's like, I don't want to make that many knives. I want to travel. It's gonna impede. I'm like, well, you're trying to make a business out of this? He's like, well, yeah, but not, I don't want to grow it that big. It's just this funny conversation.
I want it going to slow me down.
Yeah, he's like, I don't want it to slow me down, which is funny. But anyway, custom knife by Shane Hyatt. And that's it. I really enjoyed having you on the show, Tim. And
thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, appreciate it. And we'll have you back for sure.
Awesome.
All right, guys, out here.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter @SoftRep Radio.